Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you're located. My name is Denny Griffin. For the next hour, I'm going to be your host on a special show tonight addressing crimes against children. And my guest for this program is Heather Steele. Heather earned her MBA from the University of Chicago and is a passionate advocate for children in the fight to prevent child sexual abuse and provide justice for child victims. Through her education, research, and field experience, she came to understand that child pornography and child molestation are inextricably linked and growing. She also discovered that child pornography, by leaving a digital trail, is also the best way to catch child molesters mankind has ever had. She brings a strong corporate background to her position as president and CEO of the Innocent Justice Foundation, which supports law enforcement's efforts to investigate and prosecute child pornography crimes. Heather, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Before we get into the meat of the program, I do want to thank my new friends at Juror 13. This is a website I just became familiar with, and they are very active in following current criminal events in the news and trials and so forth. And they have a wealth of information on a lot of the active cases. Some of them, of course, are child-related cases. And for anyone who would like to check them out, they're at www.juror13, that's one word, all spelled out, .com. And also to my friends at Justice Interrupted for introducing me to Heather. Okay, Heather, let's. I was very stunned when we chatted a few days ago about the child pornography, child sexual abuse that goes on, well, worldwide, but this country, I believe you said, is the leader statistically. So could you tell us somewhat about your foundation and what you hope to accomplish and give us some of those figures?
Absolutely. Well, basically, a lot of people don't really know what child pornography is. And so we founded the organization to educate people about the true nature and scope of what child pornography is, and to also let people know how widespread and how dangerous it is. Here in the U.S., we are the number one producer and consumer of child pornography crime scene images in the world. And basically, we talk a lot about what child pornography really is. A lot of people have in their minds that it's baby in the bathtub photos or pictures of 17-year-olds consensual sex, quote-unquote, and it's really not. What it is crime scene photos of children, mostly prepubescent children, being sexually abused. And we produce so many of them here in the United States because a lot of people here have access to digital technology and video cameras and digital cameras and broadband internet access. And so that allows us, not only from a population standpoint, we have a lot of molesters here, but they're also taking pictures of the abuse and posting it on the internet. And there's 624,000 identified child pornography traders in the United States right now. And law enforcement only has the resources to go after 1% of those guys. And we know that each one of those guys have a large number of victims. And so we believe that going after child pornography traders is the most effective way to decimate child sexual abuse that mankind has ever had. It's the best tool we've ever had. So what we do is we work with law enforcement agencies that don't have the tools that they need to go after those 624,000 guys so that we can enable them to do their jobs.
And how have you been received by law enforcement, your foundation?
Well, you know, a lot of times law enforcement doesn't like to ask for help. I don't know what your experience was as a law enforcement officer before, but, you know, the thing is that a lot of these agencies are drowning so hard and there's so much pain involved with viewing these pictures and trying to rescue these kids, that they're completely overwhelmed, and when someone has stepped up to try to help them as much as we can, they're really grateful. And we're starting to be overwhelmed by requests right now. We're working on 13 different law enforcement requests. I just got two more in. Looks like we'll have 15 before the week is out. And it's just snowballing at this point. The more that they find out about us and the work that we do, the more telephone calls we're getting and requests we're getting.
So that would be taken, I assume, as a sign of success, that you're getting the referrals or getting the contacts.
Well, yes. I mean, we do the best we can. What we do is we write grants on behalf of the law enforcement agencies to their local communities to try to communicate the need that these agents have in their local communities. And not everybody wants to hear that this type of crime happens locally. They want to believe that it happens somewhere else, that these are pictures of children in Thailand or Russia, and it's really not a big deal. It's not involving local children, or especially if they're in a rural area, they don't really want to believe that that could possibly be happening in their area. So, you know, we have a wild range of success or failure depending on the funder that we go to for funding. So while there's a strong demand from law enforcement, our job is a tough job, and that is to educate local funders that this is really a problem that's happening in their area, and they really need to help fund their law enforcement agency. Some people listen and are moved by it, and we're able to supply that law enforcement agency with the tools they need. And there are other areas where sometimes the funders just turn away and don't want to believe it's happening.
The old ostrich thing, stick your head in the sand and pretend it's not there, huh?
Well, it's such a horrible thing to believe. You know, once you hear about it and understand it, you're obliged, I mean, basically, to do something about it, because I don't think there's anything that's happened that's as horrible as what's happening to these kids since the Nazis, because it's so widespread, it's on such a scale, and it's so soul-destroying, and it's happening to so many kids. We have to do something about it, and you just can't turn away from it. It's just amazing how many people, really want to do something about it and really want to help. And so I think what we're trying to do is get the word out to them that this is something we can't turn away from.
I want to make sure I heard you right. You said there were 624,000 estimated of these individuals here, and law enforcement only has the capability to investigate about 1%.
Well, yeah, let me explain that number a little bit deeper, because it's on the conservative side. There are 59 teams nationwide called Internet Crimes Against Children Task Forces, ICAC Task Forces, that track down child pornography traders, producers, and possessors, and guys who also lure children online through chat rooms or MySpace and things like that. And basically, they follow the guys, because anybody who deals in child pornography on the internet, either they download it, they view it on a website, they trade it, whatever, produce it and send it to their friends, they use a variety of different ways of doing that. And all of those can be digitally tracked by law enforcement. So one of those ways that they trade, they use internet relay chat, they use bulletin boards, you know, the old style of internet before it really became the web, the ways that they immediately started using it to trade child pornography as soon as the technology was there. And what's really frightening about that, if you don't mind if I digress for just a second, is that in the history of mankind, it's been very difficult for pedophiles to find each other. It's hard for them to walk up to another guy and just go, hey, I'm a pedophile, are you a pedophile? You know, it's very difficult for them to find each other and network and develop friends. But for the first time in history, the internet has allowed them to do that. And the way that they started doing that as soon as the internet came into existence was by using bulletin boards and internet relay chat. And they could develop these chat rooms in the deep, deep, deep dark web that were can be very difficult to track. But a lot of these times, these guys are going on regular chat rooms that they found that are easily accessible, that talk about incest and a lot of other areas, and they find each other, and for the first time in history, these guys feel normal. They feel like they're not freaks. They feel like, oh my gosh, here's someone who understands me. Maybe there's really nothing wrong with me. There's so many other guys out there who are like me. And so for the first time in history, pedophiles are becoming a very, very powerful group. And what they do on these groups is they take pictures of the abuse that they do and they trade them with each other. And what it does is it really normalizes the abuse. They literally have studies where these guys talk about, oh my God, I saw child pornography before I was trying to stop myself from acting on my urges. But now that I see hundreds or thousands of other guys doing what I want to do, I realize I should just go out and do that too. And so it normalizes it for them. They talk to these other guys. These guys encourage them to go out and abuse children, and they teach them how to do it and how to avoid law enforcement. So basically, while they're doing that and while they're trading all these photos that really memorialize the abuse, they do it for like trophies. Oh, look at this picture I took. Or they get social status or standing within these groups. And they say, look, I just took a picture. It's fresh. It's this kid you've never seen before. And I'll trade it for maybe one of your rare pictures in your collection. And then that person gains social status in the group. And what we're seeing is an explosion of child pornography, 6.5 million new pictures in the last 5 years. And these are local kids. These are not kids in Russia. Although there are kids in Russia that are being abused this way too. In Thailand, but the United States produces 55% of these pictures in the world. Russia only produces 23%. So these guys trade these pictures on peer-to-peer networks like LimeWire, and this is what the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, those agencies have a software program that allows them to track this peer-to-peer network trading of child pornography. And just through the peer-to-peer networks, just a couple different ones, they've been able to identify 624,000 guys. That does not include guys who are trading it just via email, who are trading it via bulletin boards, who are trading it via deep, dark internet relay chat networks, guys who are trading it via any other method, like live webcasting. They sometimes rape children and live webcast it to each other. That's not including all those guys. So that 624,000 is just peer-to-peer networks and not even all of those.
Oh, my goodness gracious. That's stunning. It's absolutely stunning to me, those kinds of numbers. And to hear that they're
right
on the low side. I mean, that's what's mind-boggling. Before we move on, would you care to give out your website address if anybody would like to get more information about your foundation?
Yeah, absolutely. We're www.innocentjustice.org. And we have a lot of information about child pornography on our website. And we also have several of the team requests that are current right now for law enforcement agencies that are seeking tools they need to hunt down these guys and rescue the children that they're victimizing.
Okay, thank you for that information. And if anybody wants to learn more and see more information, please visit Heather's website, the foundation website, and check it out. I've been there, and it's really loaded with stuff, so you won't be disappointed. And also, we have the phone lines open. If anybody has a question or comment for Heather, you can reach us at 646-478-0982. That's 646-478-0982. Heather, it's, well, I assume now the victims here are kids. Is there a particular age, or does it cease after a certain age, or what is the cutoff when we're considering a child?
Well, the statutes, state statutes and federal statutes, consider a child anybody under the age of 18. But I tell you, these law enforcement agencies are triaging the leads that they get, and they're working mostly on prepubescent children. And a lot of those cases are children under the age of 6, and there's an awful lot of children being abused now that are under the age of 3. So if they know that a child, baby, a toddler in diaper still is being abused, they're working really hard to try to go and rescue those children first. So those are most of the cases that are being worked right now. And if you want, I just spoke to an investigator today in Boone County, Kentucky, which is northern Kentucky, and basically he told me that through a child pornography investigation, they were able to arrest a step-grandfather who was abusing his 18-month-old granddaughter and taking the pictures and posting them on the web. And they caught him only through a child pornography investigation.
Wow.
So a lot of these guys are looking at pictures. There's a study done by Dr. Michael Burke and Dr. Andres Hernandez out of Butner Federal Prison in North Carolina. It's really, really interesting study. And what it shows is a lot of these guys who are offending and looking at child pornography do not limit themselves to one age group. They're basically looking at very young children all the way up until, children who are pubescent. And there also is nearly a one-to-one correlation between viewing child pornography and being a child molester. And oftentimes they molest children, all different age groups. Whatever they can get access to is usually what they end up targeting, the kind of children they end up targeting.
So these real young children, like you just mentioned, the 18-month-old being abused by a step-grandfather, and these children under 3 and so forth. Now, the molesters are, for the most part, I assume, family or friends of family. I mean, these aren't all cases where strangers are getting access to these kids. They must be have some relationship. Am I correct?
You're absolutely right. In fact, the Department of Justice statistics say that 96% of children who are abused by people within their circle of trust, and that can be family members, mostly family members when they're quite young, and other trusted adults like pastors and religious figures in their lives, or teachers and coaches, anybody that kind of has the trust of that child.
Are all molesters male?
No. There are quite a few women, actually, who are selling their children on the Internet to pedophiles and molesters, who invite molesters to come and molest their children. And we're working with a team in Tennessee, and they actually had a case where one of their local Tennessee residents went over the border to Atlanta, Georgia, to rape a 3-year-old child. And the mother had basically invited him to come do that. And there also are women who molest children, and they molest boys and girls. But there have been cases where a mother was molesting a baby, still in diapers and taking pictures and posting it on the internet.
So these pictures then are, that these people take to gain some kind of elevated status or in their social groups or the groups they want to belong to or be recognized by, they're like building a resume, huh?
Yeah, really it is, because, you know, for the first time they actually have friends where they feel like they can be themselves and they can really get recognition for the way they feel inside. And there are some elite, let's call it elite groups of pedophiles that only allow access into their special clubs or groups if a prospective member produces 10,000 child pornography images themselves.
Oh,
and they have to prove it by making the child hold up a sign while they're photographing the child that has a certain phrase that the members say that it should have, or a newspaper with the date, so they can prove that they're fresh and not taken from somewhere else.
Okay. Now, when we get past, let's say we start getting children now who are still legally children but are up in the 12, early teen years. Now, is that where you get more into the chat room seductions?
Yeah. The law enforcement agencies are, you know, when they do these luring investigations, they deal with guys who lure children. They oftentimes pose as 12, 13, 14-year-old children on the internet, and or the mothers of young children, in order to start a conversation or, you know, see what this guy is going to do. And it often doesn't take long. I mean, probably everybody has seen To Catch a Predator. It computers can crash because so many predators go after them at one time.
I'm just checking the chat room here. We've got a couple of inquiries. The mothers who sell their children to these pedophiles and molesters, do they get in trouble? Can they be? They can be charged, I assume, for that by either state or federal law, or no?
Yes, most of the time. It depends on the state law, but I believe that it's accessory to a crime in every state. And I have heard of cases of mothers being prosecuted for it. They usually don't get as much time as the child molesters themselves, but I have seen some cases where a mother gets 8 to 10 years. There have been cases where the mother gets a lot less, and there's been a high-profile case in Massachusetts recently, and I don't remember off the top of my head the name of the woman, but she actually sold her children to several child molesters and was not given very much jail time for that. But they do get prosecuted, yes.
Well, that's encouraging. And you say they sell they sell the kids. What type of money are we talking? Do they do it for drugs and different things, or cash, or what can they make on one of these deals?
Well, it's a good question. I myself don't have any numbers as far as if they actually sell them for money. Sometimes they give up these children to the pedophiles just so they can have a boyfriend or someone to support them. Sometimes it is in exchange for drugs. And sometimes I wouldn't doubt that it's for cash. But whatever it is, and sometimes the women participate in the abuse. Recently, it's news stories all over the place, but one in Georgia just last week and this week, two people, one was a couple, Mary and Stanley Rushton. They were abusing a child in their home, and they were inviting other child molesters to come over and abuse the child. I don't know if they got money for that, you know, or if it just was because they enjoyed watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
your comment that the one lady got 8 to 10 year prison sentence. Our chat room person said that's not good enough. thinks it should be a taste more than that. Another question we have through the chat is we tend to think, that most of these molester types are sleazeball lowlifes. But the question is, are there professional businessmen, for example, executive types that are involved in this stuff too?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you asked because, again, the misperception is it's just that ugly outcast guy. You would see him from a mile away that he looks hideous and has no friends and, you know, kind of homeless guy. But really the truth is that the vast majority of these guys are white, upper middle, middle class, married. So the statistics are, if there's a government study that was published in 2005 on child pornography offenders, and 91% of them were white. I believe 42% of them were college educated, 41% had children of their own, and around 60% are or were married. Go ahead.
That's not the picture, the mental picture I had of what we were talking about here. I figured, maybe a well-educated or successful business-type person, a very small minority. That really is surprising to me. There would be that high percentage of the non low-life types that are involved in this kind of thing. So it's actually a wide-open area, this pornography business and child sexual abuse. It's not limited to any specific social class or income or educational class, is it?
Absolutely not. And I can just roll off the top of my head some of the guys that have been caught. A business professor at University of Pennsylvania at Wharton School of Business. There's been here in San Diego, there have been pediatricians and respiratory therapists at the hospital here that rape the children in the hospital. There have been heads of boys clubs and girls clubs. The head of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure in Orange County was a woman who was caught with child pornography. There are doctors, there are lawyers, there are politicians, there are state assembly persons who are caught with child pornography. One of the former Virginia head of the ACLU was caught with child pornography. The list goes on and on and on. There are abbots of monasteries. There have been policemen. There have been bus drivers. There are Olympic athletes who were caught with it recently, one in Canada. Every spectrum. Firemen, a lot of firemen. I don't know why.
Now, how difficult is it for you personally? I mean, hearing these stories, does it get to you? I mean, is it tough for you to deal with on a personal level?
Well, I think how could it not be difficult? Because, at a certain point, you're going to put yourself in the position of that child who will never be able to lead a normal life again after what's happened to them, and they'll be victimized for the rest of their lives because those pictures, once they're on the internet, never go away. And so every time someone views that picture anywhere in the world, that child is victimized over and over and over again, and that child knows that even when they're 80 years old, that those pictures are still going to be distributed and used for someone to masturbate to. And they're going to die, and those pictures are still going to be out there. So it is difficult, but when the going gets tough on that side, I think of the investigators that are out there every day. They have to view thousands upon thousands of pictures of children being abused, And 20% of the child pornography collections that are seized by police actually have images of torture, of hurting children. So police officers have to look at so many of these pictures. And I don't. Thank God I've never seen one of these, and I hope I never have to. But I can keep going if I can support them in their work. Thank God they're doing that work for us.
I'm glad you mentioned the fact that lives are ruined here. In other words, some children end up dying as a result of these encounters, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But the ones that just because they aren't killed, murdered in the process, that doesn't mean that as soon as the molestation stops, everything's good. I mean, there are lingering effects of this. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely. And especially if a child is not able to get counseling immediately upon, you know, this happening. I mean, only 5 to 8% of children ever come forward in their lifetimes to report this abuse. So that means that, I mean, of those, only a small number are actually getting help for the problems that happen. And there are a lot of problems that can really affect these people in the rest of their lives. And they include, you know, teen pregnancy, acting out, getting involved, getting in trouble, a lot of suicide, self-harming, eating disorders, cutting themselves, all sorts of things. And, you know, that's on the more severe side, but even on the quote-unquote mild side, they have trouble with relationships once they grow up. They have, troubles just forgetting about it. There's a lot of victims that I speak to say there's not a day in their lives that they don't think about what happened to them then, the complete betrayal of trust of people who are supposed to be protecting you. It's such a young age, and at a formative age, it's very, very difficult for them to overcome it and to go on to lead normal lives. Many of them spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, if they can afford it, on therapy to just try to take care of it. It's a travesty, and it takes up billions and billions of dollars of resources and lives where, you know, people aren't reaching their full potential. It's very sad.
Heather, what do you think? Now, obviously, this is a major problem. And do you think, first of all, is the public aware of what's going on in the pornography, the child sexual abuse arena, to really appreciate it, do you think? And do you feel the laws, generally speaking, I know each state has different laws, of course, but do you feel that that overall the laws are adequate, or are there shortcomings?
Well, okay, two different questions, I guess. But the first question is, does the public really know about this? And I'd say very, very few people know about it. And I myself had no idea about it until just a few years ago. And I think a lot of people don't want to believe that so much of it is happening. There's a CDC study. I mean, these are government studies. A CDC study showing that 25% of girls and 16% of boys are molested in the United States today. So I think, you know, if we were to have bird flu and 25% of our kids got polio or bird flu, there'd be people screaming that we needed to do something about it immediately. I mean, polio only affected 3.7% of the population, and as soon as they had a technology for a cure, they wiped it out in 50 years here in the Americas. But for child pornography, where we have a cure and we have a way to treat it and get rid of, you know, this horrible type of abuse, no one is doing anything. There's hardly any funding going to these ICAC teams. There are 59 ICAC teams nationwide, and they share $30 million in funding. And it's almost nothing. It's laughable because they have to take their salaries, their vehicles, their hardware, their software, anything that they need from that, and it just it goes almost nowhere compared to the amount of crime that we have. So I think, you know, our job is getting the word out to people so that they understand the scope of it. And the second thing is, are the laws adequate enough? And, well, let me tell you, I think before we had child pornography as a tool, I think the system was broken. And if you still go through that traditional system, it can be very disappointing for victims. And the traditional system is where a victim comes forward and reports a crime. And like I said, only 5 to 8% of them do. And then police only are able to arrest 29% of those reports, make an arrest in 29% of those. And we know that prosecutors don't always take these crimes to court because they don't want to put the victim on the stand, or they think that the child may not be a credible witness. And prosecutors oftentimes want 100% conviction rate because they're elected officials. So we know that in the traditional method, less than 1% of these crimes were getting prosecuted or getting to a point where we had a conviction. And of those convictions, the guys would normally get 7 years, of which they would serve 3. But the good news is, with child pornography, prosecutors love to take child pornography cases because no child needs to come forward. There is no child testimony. There's very strong evidence. And there's a 93 to 95% conviction rate on child pornography cases. And it's fairly common to have a federal court involved, because oftentimes these guys are trading child pornography images over state lines. So it becomes a federal case. And at that standard, there are pretty good sentences at the federal level. It's 10 years for possession, 20 years for distribution around. It can be 5, I think, to 30, but the median is like 20 years, and that's not a scientific number, but it's the kind of sentences I see for distribution. And production can be up to 30 years. For production, sometimes they'll get them for possession and distribution and production. And if you combine it with state laws for molesting the child that you have the picture of, you can put these guys away for life. And it's a very, very powerful tool. Now, states differ according to how they charge child pornography crimes. I happen to live in California, which is one of the worst states in the union on their sentences on child pornography crimes. It is a felony here, but it is also still on the books as a misdemeanor. So they can charge it as a misdemeanor or a felony, and the felony is not very strong. And there are 4 other states that I believe still have child pornography possession as a misdemeanor on their books.
So there's still a little work to be done in that area then, about getting laws and penalties.
Absolutely. And I'd love to see it like Arizona. Arizona is a great state where there's a 10-year mandatory minimum per picture charged.
Per picture.
And per picture. And there was someone, a high school teacher, was caught and charged on 20 images, and he got 200 years in jail. And he can't get out early. There's no early release. He's not serving concurrently. They're consecutive sentences. And he appealed it to the Arizona Supreme Court, and they upheld the conviction.
My compliments to the prosecutors and the judge and the legislature for putting that kind of a law in place. Now, we mentioned before of how these victims who survive can, you know, have major problems down the road, but not all the victims survive. Sometimes the child dies during the abuse. And I want to mention one case, and I'm going to ask you to mention some more. But the case that just came to my attention was a Texas girl, a young 6-year-old named Hannah Mack. And Hannah was found hanging from the rafters in a garage near her home, nude from the waist down, and had been raped. And as I read about that, my blood just boiled. because one of the perpetrators admitted in a plea bargain last Friday that he was guilty, and there was also DNA evidence. But apparently he wanted to take the death penalty potential off the table, so he made a deal. And he's also implicated another party in the crimes. And this so affected me that I want to do a separate show about Hannah. So I'm not going to dig into it or dwell on it very much right now. But I found the whole circumstances nauseating, and I'm sure that that's the case with all of these situations. So do you have any other cases that you'd like to mention where the child died as a result of the sexual abuse?
Well, yes, and I think, you know, foremost, it's the reason why we talk so much about reporting child pornography as being essential. It's really important because people find child pornography all the time on loved ones' computers or on friends' iPods or on digital cameras, and very few people go forward to report because they feel like maybe that this person could just use therapy and that everything would be okay, or maybe I just want to get away from this person and not think about it, and if I get myself to safety, then I've done my job. And I've talked to women over and over again who have found child pornography, they have not reported it, they have divorced their husbands, and they've moved on, but they never went to the police with it. And the reason why it's so important to do that is because there are two areas where a child could be killed. One is the person who has the child pornography could be using it to work themselves up to the point where they see children being killed on the child pornography, they achieve sexual release, and then they decide they're going to go out and do that. And the other thing is sometimes there are images of children being abused over time on the computer, and those children need to be rescued. And sometimes, based on clues within the photos, police can get a fix on where that child is and rescue them before they are killed. And so that's why it's really important to report. And so I'll give you, if we have time, two stories from each scenario. The first scenario is David Westerfield here in San Diego was looking at a lot of child pornography. There are people in his family who knew that, who did not report it to law enforcement. And he kidnapped, raped, and killed Danielle Van Damme. However, if someone had reported his child pornography and police had been able to capture him, she would still be alive today. And the other case I want to talk about is a little girl in North Carolina who was 6 years old, and she was being kept in a dog cage. She was being beaten, urinated on, defecated on, sodomized, and forced into oral sex. And the pictures of her abuse over time, over many months, were put together in a series of 450 images, which were found by an investigator in Europe. He saw that she was North American, her brownie uniform, basically, and he sent it to the Toronto Child Exploitation Team. They dropped everything. And with 17 investigators plus the FBI, they hunted down every clue in those pictures, and within 48 hours were able to turn up on the doorstep of that girl and rescue her and save her life, because they felt like in 72 hours this girl would be dead. They weren't even sure that she would still be alive because the abuse was getting so much progressively worse. So we can rescue kids. We can save their lives. And the way to do it is really by reporting child pornography to your local law enforcement agency.
Heather, let me, there's a case currently, another Florida case. Of course, it was one of the most followed cases for the past several months have been the Kaylee Anthony case, and now this Haley Cummings, a 5-year-old, is missing, And I have no idea, you know, what happened to her, whether it involves any type of sexual abuse or what the circumstances are. And I'm not saying there's any porn or sexual abuse involved here. But the initial reports of the investigation were that there were, I believe it was 44 registered sex offenders in the nearby vicinity of the girl's home. And some people thought that was quite a, I think the whole community is only about 5,000 people, and thought it was quite a high percentage. I've heard now that it's actually nationally a low percentage. And someone else commented that those are only the ones that are required to register. They've been caught and gone through the system. And that there are some of these people who are passive, you know, watching the pictures of others and watching other people do it and living out their fantasies through someone else's actions. And it may be years before they actually can't stay passive any longer, and they want to be part of the action. They want to do this thing or these things themselves. So, I mean, if, you know, how many, in addition to the 44 or whatever registered sex offenders, how many potential offenders are in our communities? I mean, that haven't been caught yet, or maybe haven't acted yet, but are kind of time bombs waiting to go off. I'm scared to think of what those numbers could be.
Well, by our calculations, in the old method of trying to catch child molesters, that way where the child comes forward and reports and the police, you know, if they have evidence, they can make an arrest. If it isn't immediately when the abuse happens, they may not be able to make an arrest. Basically, that traditional system really yields less than 1% conviction rate. So we know that for every 44 out there, and for each one guy who's out there, there's another 99 who haven't been caught. Well, the thing about child pornography is that I, too, thought in the beginning maybe there are guys who were just looking at it and they're not acting on it. But there's been one government study, the study by Hernandez and Burke in the federal prison in North Carolina. And what they did is they asked all types of sex offenders how many victims they'd had. They did it in treatment, and they had an 18-month or 24-month treatment program where they built up the trust with the offenders. And they asked them, they had all sorts of different categories of offenders, ones that had traveled to have sex with children, ones that had viewed child pornography, and ones that had been caught molesting children. And of the child molesters, they found that 85% of them admitted to having victims, child sex contact victims. And an additional 13% denied having victims, but at the end they failed the polygraph test on the question. And the remaining 2% said, I didn't have any victims, and they passed the polygraph test. And but they said, if I'd had opportunity, I would have taken it to rape a child. So basically, there aren't very many of them that are just looking at this and not doing it. It's nearly a one-to-one correlation between viewing child pornography and actually molesting children. And what they found in the study is that most of these offenders, you know, it depends on how old they are, but most of these offenders started offending before they ever looked at child pornography. So very many of the child pornography offenders had started raping younger children when they were children. So they might have started raping family members, younger cousins, younger siblings, children that they were babysitting, before they ever got to be the age 16. I believe there was an average age of 16 at first offense. And they didn't start looking at child pornography until they were adults. So it's a little bit of reverse than what we would believe, but a lot of these guys are absolutely offenders before they even look at their first picture of child pornography.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I'm surprised. I would have thought just the opposite. Now, so let's say that and this would apply to everybody. For example, my daughters are grown and have their own families, but we have grandchildren, and anybody, I think, who has a sister, a younger sister, of course, daughters, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, virtually all of us should be on the lookout for this type of thing, as you were saying. And if we see something that, you know, maybe notice that a member of our family is computer is loaded down with porn sites and so forth, then it's up to us, as tough as that might be, to do something about it. Am I correct in that assumption?
Well, and absolutely. And so many families, so many people that I talk to come up to me after I give presentations, or people I meet at cocktail parties, and they say, you know, one woman said, I found it, or my sister and brother-in-law found it on my brother's computer, and he's got two kids. And we didn't report it. We just thought he could go to therapy. Do you think the kids are in danger? And yeah, the kids are in danger, and therapy is not going to help. The vast majority of members of the Association for Treatment of Sexual Abusers believe that there is no cure for this. They can't stop themselves. So anybody who is viewing pictures of children being raped and getting sexual gratification from it needs to be removed from children. So we need to get law enforcement involved.
And right now, I'm trying to think. I realize that if it's a family member or a close friend or something, it's a tough thing to have to do that. The easiest thing would be just kind of ignore it, or the people who divorce their husband or whatever when they find that out, but don't report it to law enforcement. So if you find this stuff and it offends you and you know there's something wrong with it, you've got to take that extra step, as you say, because just trying to say, well, you ought to go see a counselor, maybe you've got some problems, isn't sufficient. It's not going to cut it. You've got to notify the authorities.
Well, outside of the fact that you may be rescuing children at that point from, you know, children in your family may be being abused, and you don't know, because even when children are asked, they often deny the abuse. 80% of children, 79% of children who are asked and who are actually being abused deny that they're being abused. So besides the fact that you could be rescuing your own children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews by reporting the child pornography, and maybe rescuing the children that are depicted in those pictures on the computer, there are also other reasons. And some of the reasons are this may be the only opportunity to have evidence against this person. There have been lots of times where people have found child pornography and not reported it, and then a year or two later, there's evidence that there's child molestation happening, and there's no evidence of the child molestation. Maybe even the child would come forward and say that they're being molested, but no one believes the child. But if there were child pornography involved, then that leads to an arrest. So you never know what's going to happen a year or 2 years from now. If you don't report it now, you're almost an accessory to the crime yourself by not reporting it. And believe me, I know that people who don't report it, it lasts a lifetime. You take it with you wherever you go, and the knowledge that there are children being raped because you didn't report it from a purely personal standpoint, it's almost unbearable to know that for the rest of your life, to carry that with you.
And if a child dies, of course, that just makes it worse yet, right? If you knew that you could have actually saved a life, you're right. It's got to be a tough thing to live with, knowing that you had a chance and you failed to act.
Right, and it really comes down to a tough decision: is are you going to be on the side of good, or are you going to be on the side of evil? And when you see evil and do nothing about it, then automatically, you know, unfortunately, you've aided and abetted this horrible, horrible crime continuing to happen. So we all want to feel good about ourselves, and we all want to feel like we're good people. And sometimes good people have to make really hard choices, and that's That's what it takes to be a good person. It's easy to be evil, but it's hard to be good.
By the way, I forgot to mention, one of your associates is in the chat room named Karen, and Karen said to say hi to you.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for listening.
I want to get back for a minute to the Hannah Mack case and just say that Heather has been kind enough to agree to be a guest on the Heather Mack special, where we're going to get into the details of her, the abuse that apparently took place, and then the actual murder. And I don't know, are you fairly familiar with that case? It was a 2007 thing, and I just never heard about it before. How about you, Heather?
Well, I heard about it when it happened, and it's just, you know, no surprise. It's absolutely no surprise to me anymore when, you know, someone who's accused of raping and killing a child is caught with child pornography. It's almost commonplace. So, you know, for me, based on the government studies that I've been reading and all the stories I hear from law enforcement, you know, it's pretty common to see that happen, that there's some connection between child pornography and acting out on children. So, you know, it's one of many, many, many stories that I see every day where, you know, the children are horribly abused or sometimes even killed, and they're killed all around the world, including here in the United States.
Yeah, we're the number one. We're a world leader in something, I guess, but it's those statistics here, and then you take all these other countries, worldwide, God, it's really just a staggering numbers. It's really incredible.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, but, you know, we can't turn away from it. Just the same way we can't turn away, you know, if something really horrible was happening and it is nationwide, you just can't turn away from these kids. These are kids in our neighborhoods, kids in our families, little babies even with, you know, still wearing diapers, and they need our help. Every one of us as adults is responsible for trying to make sure that the children in our lives are safe. And so we all have a responsibility as adults to do something about this.
Now, what can we do as individuals, as citizens, to help? Is there something we can do? Do you need, in addition, if we see anything reporting it, but other than that, is there some type of volunteer work, or is there maybe through your foundation? What can interested people do?
Absolutely. We take volunteers. We take cash donations. Anybody who wants to make an in-kind donation of technology, they know a company. We've had people who were working at companies that were going out of business, and they donated, for example, Pfizer in Ann Arbor went out of business, and one of their employees heard about us, and they donated 25 desktops, 4 servers, and 4 laptops to their local ICAC team, which were incredibly helpful to the team. So if you know of anybody who has computers that they can donate, if you want to volunteer, if you can give cash donations, if you can help with fundraising events, if you can help get the word out about your local team that needs tools in your local area, any of those areas are really helpful. Just call us with any ideas that you have. We'll be glad of the help.
Okay, and why don't you give out your website URL one more time?
It's www.innocentjustice.org.
Okay, folks, so if you have been as affected by this information as I have, please visit the website and learn more. The information is there for you. And if you're in a position to help in some way through donations of cash, software, hardware, what have you, or your time, please do it, because this obviously is a problem that needs to be dealt with and dealt with soon. And we're just about out of time. I want to thank Heather very much for being my guest tonight. And I intend to schedule a follow-up show about Hannah Mack within the next few days. And I will post the information, and we'll get right into that case and take a good close look at it. Heather, thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you again shortly.
Thank you very much, Denny. I look forward to talking to you soon.
Good night now. And
good
thanks
night.
To everyone who listened, and stay tuned, and we're going to do this again, and I think you will be as upset as I am when you hear the story behind Hannah Mack's death. Thank you very much, and good night.